Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. On this episode, we're going to cover a seminal 1971 film that tackles the awkwardness of teenage sexual awakening and the lifelong yearning for something more meaningful and poignant that permeates the small town of Anarene, Texas. Peter Bogdanovich's magnum opus, The Last Picture Show. So, with that being said, we hope you enjoy this wonderful talkback.
Good afternoon, everyone. We've been presenting and discussing here films that we think lift our spirits in some conventional way, with beautiful music or a brilliant comedy, or perhaps ones that provide some piercingly true glimpse at people's struggles or a particular moment in time. But we've had a few people ask us, why this particular film? Why The Last Picture Show? Well, I think you can look at it in a number of ways. For example, the mournful passing of a certain American way of life after World War II, the beauty and ache of youthful romance and sexual desire, or simply a high point in an extraordinary period of American mainstream filmmaking. And helping me along with it is my friend and invaluable colleague, Max Alvarez.
Hello, Gary, and welcome, everybody. It is such a pleasure to be talking about The Last Picture Show, which, as Gary mentioned, is part of this extraordinary artistic resurgence in American filmmaking between the decline of the studio filmmaking in the 1960s and sort of the rise of the conglomerate era in the 70s, when you had directors making very personal artistic films that were successful in this case. So this is an extraordinary film to show, in addition for all the reasons Gary mentions.
And Peter Bogdanovich is an Upper West Sider, an immigrant Upper West Sider, but his parents arrived here in the late 30s, right? From, we believe, Serbia and Austria, respectively, right? Is his mother?
There was a bit of Yugoslavia background in Serbia, and his parents reached New York in 1939, which was the year that Bogdanovich himself was born. And actually, there is a bit of a continuity from when we talked about the 400 Blows, because you have, in that case, it was a film critic and a cineast who became a director. And here we have Bogdanovich, who did write a lot about films and review films and was a journalist before he became a director.
He was a movie mad kid who schooled himself in the masters of that time, and of course still the masters, John Ford, Howard Hawks, Alfred Hitchcock, Orson Welles. And in the early 60s, he met Dan and Toby Talbot at the legendary New Yorker Theater at Broadway and 88th Street, which they operated from 1960 to about 1973. And he became friends with them, lifelong friends evidently, and wrote program notes for the theater, did some programming, and then eventually got involved promoting retrospectives of directors like Hawks and Hitchcock when their new films were released in the early 60s. And not to be left out here is a story which actually has been kind of unfolding on some parallel media. In 1962, relatively early in life, he married Polly Platt. They were married for about 10 years. Polly was a writer, production designer, and played a key but mostly uncredited role in Peter's early films, most particularly The Last Picture Show. And her life is being told in two podcasts that are going on, one called You Must Remember This from an L.A. Writer named Karina Longworth, and also a TCM podcast hosted by Ben Mankiewicz called The Plot Thickens, in which Bogdanovich is telling the story of his long relationship with Polly and her influences on him. So this is great stuff, I think, to dig into, along with what we're going to be talking about shortly.
Absolutely. And what Polly Platt did is production design is something we don't think about, but it's to help to determine the look of a film and also art direction, making sure that it has captures a certain period and props and a visual look. And their collaboration started with the movie Targets, which was made in 1968, a low-budget film, but this was their first major film that they worked on together. And the popular sentiments are that after they went their separate ways, his films didn't have the same quality that they did when he worked with her. I would argue that the same went for her on the film she worked on. They didn't quite have the same quality on the film she worked with him. But it's an important collaboration.
And apparently Bogdanovich was given the novel, the Larry McMurtry novel, circa 1966 or so by the actor Sal Mineo, whom he had met on the set of John Ford's Cheyenne Autumn a couple of years earlier. There had been one previous Larry McMurtry novel, which had been made into a film, and it's still a terrific film, HUD, with Paul Newman and an Oscar-winning performance by Patricia Neal. still holds up, covers similar territory, but a little bit different from the milieu of the Last Picture Show. Now, there were lots of risk-taking and deep diving going on in American mainstream films at this time, but this was probably the first movie shot in black and white, major film, probably since Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf several years earlier, right?
That sounds absolutely correct, because the studios stopped really approving black and white films after 1966 because they were worried about TV sales. And so a director really had to fight for it. Now, actually, a year after it's Virginia Woolf, we do have In Cold Blood by Richard Brooks, another Columbia film. He had to fight to get that in black and white. And then, fortunately, in this case, Bogdanovich had some support through the production company BBS, which had produced Easy Rider and Five Easy Pieces for Columbia Pictures. So they sided with him on the idea of shooting in black and white. The studio didn't really argue. That came out of a discussion with Orson Welles, because Bogdanovich wanted a very much of a depth of field look to The Last Picture Show, where the foreground and the background is often in focus. Welles thought that it works best with black and white. And I remember at the time the film came out, Bogdanovich said that the town that was supposed to be Anarene, Texas, looked too pretty in color, and he didn't want that look. So it was also for obviously atmospheric reasons as well.
And he himself had never been to Texas, as far as we understand it, right?
Apparently, he says that he did not visit Texas until they were ready to do production. That's quite extraordinary. And it's my argument that an artist doesn't have to be from an area or from a particular culture to make a powerful film about that area or culture. And Bogdanovich, he was very smart. He did seek out details from the locals. There's an actor in the film, the young man who wears a black cowboy hat, and he's always hanging out with the guys. That's the actor Lloyd Catlett. He was from West Texas, and he knew about the accents, and he worked with the actors to make sure they got the dialects accurate, and Bogdanovich encouraged that.
And was Jeff Bridges' stunt double, apparently, in the film as well, as we understand it. You mentioned Orson Welles, and I remember one of the key reviews of the film when it came out in the Newsweek magazine, the late film critic Paul Zimmerman, who compared the film to The Magnificent Ambersons, which is another film about the dying of an era, the end of an era, and what happens to the people who are involved in it. Now, you know, usually, Max, we show the trailer from the film relatively early on in our discussion, but we weren't that impressed with the trailer this time around, and we felt that there's a scene in the picture that, to me, has always been really the heart and soul of the movie, and we decided we would show that as just a standalone clip today.
Her and her husband was young and miserable with one another, like so many young married folks are. I thought they'd change with some age, but it didn't turn out that way.
Being married always so miserable?
No, not really. About 80% of the time, I guess. We ought to go to a real fishing tank next year. I don't do to think about things like that too much. If she was here, I'd probably be just as crazy now as I was then in about 5 minutes.
So that's Ben Johnson in his Oscar-winning performance. And of course, he had become, if not quite a star, a regular supporting player in a lot of Westerns in the 50s and 60s, including some classics like John Ford's She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, Wagon Master. And his equestrian skills prompted one critic to say he looked like he had probably been born on a horse. He had a beautiful grace on it. We don't ever see him on one in The Last Picture Show, but to me, this is also kind of one of these quintessential examples of how just slight movement of a camera in or out of a close-up can really possess some kind of almost inexpressible power here. And Max, there was a whole story about how this scene was shot and didn't quite turn out the way the director had intended.
It didn't. And in watching the film recently, I was surprised because as he's talking, there's a shot of the lake. And then they cut back to Ben Johnson. And as someone who's done a lot of editing work in the past, the first thing that went through my mind is there must have been a problem when they shot this, because that's known as a cutaway. And it turns out Bogdanovich had wanted it to be an unbroken camera movement, but there were problems in the take where the camera was pulling away and Timothy Bottoms was a little late with his dialogue. And then they had to redo the whole thing. And there were some other issues. So Bogdanovich, who edited the film himself by hand, had to do a little cheating with coverage. But the scene still is very, very impactful. And Gary, you should share the sales job that had to be done to get Ben Johnson to take the role, because he was a very conservative man and was very uncomfortable about this, the language and the sexuality in the film.
Well, he was friendly with John Ford, of course, had been in a number of his pictures and asked his advice regularly. And of course, Ford was constantly very saltily assessing at that point in his life how his various stars, what they were doing and so forth. He said about John Wayne, oh, Duke's up in Seattle shooting some junk, playing a cop, for Christ's sake. And then Johnson asked him about this part. And then Ford, of course, having met Peter Bogdanovich and being familiar with the material, said, for Christ's sake, what do you want to be, Duke's sidekick for the rest of your life? So he took the part. And of course, the rest is glory and history on his part, and kind of gave his career a second lease on life. A lot of young directors cast him, like John Milius and the Dillinger, Steven Spielberg and the Sugarland Express. It's a beautiful piece of work.
And he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, just as Cloris Leachman did for Best Supporting Actress. And Bogdanovich is known as an actor's director. And that's something we don't hear a lot of, because filmmakers are usually obsessed with the technology and they often don't know how to deal with human beings. But Bogdanovich, because he had done some acting in the past, he'd worked with Stella Adler, he loved working with actors. And you see that in this film, the loving detail in every performance, down to the small walk-on role. And what Bogdanovich did during production, he pretty much segregated the actors from the crew. He wanted to build camaraderie between the actors. The crew got upset about that, but it certainly was very helpful in creating a community among the characters. And what was also fascinating was that Ellen Burstyn was given her choice of three roles. The role she plays, the Eileen Brennan role as the waitress, and also the role of Coach Popper's sexually frustrated wife. And she chose the one she took. And that shows how much confidence Bogdanovich had in her as an artist.
Well, before we move on to this glorious cornucopia of actresses here, one more note about that great scene. It came during a time and a moment in the shoot where Peter Bogdanovich's dad passed away just as they were about to shoot that scene. I apparently retired in nearby Phoenix. And also, Polly Platz and his marriage was breaking up in large part because Bogdanovich had become notably infatuated with Sybil Shepherd on the set during the shooting of the film. And then, of course, it's a key scene in the film. One can imagine the pressure must have been enormous on him at that day when they started shooting the scene.
Absolutely. He had discovered Sybil Shepherd on the cover of Glamour magazine in a supermarket. And he said to an assistant, find that girl. And she was eventually cast as JC. And as you say, things developed between them during the production. The Platt-Bogdanovich marriage was already tense at that time, but it certainly, you can just imagine that it got a little more so. And the other thing that I was thinking of about where it really must have been difficult is in when the funeral of Sam the Lion, that actually was filmed right after Bogdanovich returned from his father's funeral in Phoenix. So there's this tremendous gravity and sadness over that scene, understandably so. And at the same time, you also see the homage to John Ford and the way the camera is placed and the great sky above the funeral gatherers. There are visual references to Orson Welles. There, of course, are references to directors like Howard Hawks and Alan Dwan in the posters at the Royal Theater and in the films they see.
Right. Those two clips that we do see in the theater, I think, are beautifully, lovingly chosen. The Father of the Bride by Vincent Minnelli. And then, of course, Red River by Howard Hawks towards the end of the film. And we'll save it, that telling last line, for a little bit later. But now, of course, when we first saw the film in the 70s, the cut of the movie was a little bit different than it is today. Sometime in the late 80s, early 90s, Bogdanovich went back with the studio's cooperation and put about 7 to 10 minutes or so back into the film that had been taken out for the original release, so that it runs now about 127, 128 minutes. And the biggest omission was the notorious scene in the pool hall between Clue Gallagher and Sybil Shepherd, which ironically seems to be the only scene in the film where we see any of the characters engaging in any real sexual rapture. You know, there's so much kind of humiliation and initiation and embarrassment and hesitation going on through much of the romantic and other kinds of yearning in the movie. But there's something special about this film. I guess they felt perhaps imbalanced the film in some emotional way. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right, because, boy, if anything, the film certainly captures the sexual awkwardness of youth. I mean, everything else is so awkward, that even the pool party scene, the making out of the pickup truck. And the scene that follows that scene that you mentioned was a challenge for Ellen Burstyn, because think about it. What happens after that? She hears a truck approaching. She recognizes it as the truck of her lover. Expectation. She sees her daughter coming
out in her
shock. Her daughter's obviously had been with her lover. There's another emotion there. Then there's anger, but then the daughter is being a daughter and very vulnerable. So now her motherly instincts have to kick in, all within the course of a minute, and there's no dialogue. And Ellen Burstyn brought this to Bogdanovich's attention. She says, I go through five emotions here without dialogue. And Bogdanovich grinned and said, I know. And so she loved that challenge.
Well,
a couple of other little tidbits that were added, as you say, by Bogdanovich was when we see the shepherd and Bottoms and Bridges in the car singing the school anthem as a dog is running by.
Whether in defeat or victory, we will always be true. And Reed High School, we love you and we'll fight for you.
Irene High School, we love you.
Exactly. And there was a very, that beautiful shot where Timothy Bottoms is driving through the town at night. He passes Sam's store and he passes the Royal Theater showing Winchester 73. That was also not in the original cut of the film.
Well, a lot of work went into that mother-daughter scene, I'm sure, in rehearsal, and it paid off. But a couple of other key scenes in the film, the director insisted on not rehearsing, right, at the very end.
Absolutely. There's two devastating scenes towards the end when Timothy Bottoms sees the dead body of the young boy who's been sleeping in the street, who was hit by a truck, I believe. Bogdanovich did not want that scene rehearsed. And he said to the crew, we have to treat this like the dynamiting of a bridge, like the bridge on the River Kwai. We only get one chance to shoot it.
Another Columbia thing.
And you can imagine the staging of the camera and the focus and the actor. That shows tremendous faith in Timothy Bottoms and Sam Bottoms, that they were able to do that so well. And he also didn't want Cloris Leachman to show the scene that comes up afterwards when Bottoms comes over to her house again.
I haven't done anything wrong. Why can't I quit apologizing? You're the one who ought to be sorry. I wouldn't still be in my bathrobe if it hadn't been for you. I had my clothes on hours ago. You're the one who made me quit caring if I got dressed or not. I guess just because your friend got killed, you want me to forget what you did and make it all right? I'm not sorry for you. You'd have left Billy too, just like you left me.
He did not want to see her rehearse that.
Devastating. I just watching it again, I hadn't seen the picture in a number of years, but that's just so beautifully played.
It is, and I remember an interview Bogdanovich gave with American Film in the late 70s, where he claimed he had to fight for that ending. I think there was some resistance to that ending because it was considered very downbeat and so on. But I was thinking that what follows, it's a very sad conclusion, but when you see the reprisal of the actors and who they play, and you have the Hank Williams Sr. music, it's kind of exhilarating at the end in a way.
Well, we talked about how there can be kind of a tonic effect of seeing all the actors on screen at the end of a picture, particularly if they're less familiar to us.
And many of them were at this time because they weren't stars yet.
That's right. Timothy Bottoms, Jeff Bridges, Sybil Shepherd, all for all intents and purposes, making their screen debuts. And it's probably not well known by many viewers, but in fact, Bogdanovich's career had many ups and downs after this film. But about 20 years later, he made a sequel to The Last Picture Show called Texasville, again, based on a Larry McMurtry novel, and with at least a half a dozen of the main cast in there, Jeff Bridges being a successful oil man 30 or so years later, Timothy Bottoms having some mental problems, unfortunately. Sybil Shepherd divorced with a couple of kids. Cloris Leachman, also in the film, Randy Quaid. And the studio took about 20 minutes out of it, and it just was not successful. I think he's tried to reconstitute the film over the years. I don't know how successful.
Yeah, it was obviously a checkerboard career for Bogdanovich. This was the first of three successive hits he had. He was very clever. He switched gears entirely the next year. He made What's Up, Doc, the slapstick comedy, G-rated film. Then he made Paper Moon. All of those three were successful. Then there were some very expensive financial failures, and which were critically attacked, I believe, unfairly. And there were all sorts of other issues over the years, unfortunately. But I consider him such a major talent of that era.
You and I have talked about this, and I think, you know, there's four or five of those films that are well worth visiting now. I think most of them can be gotten on one ancillary format or another. Daisy Miller, At Long Last Love, Nickelodeon, St. Jack, The Thing Called Love.
I love The Thing Called. Nobody talks about that. It wasn't even opened in theaters, but a real talent. And I think critics seemed to turn on him not long after this film came out because they loved The Last Picture Show, and they were disappointed that subsequent films weren't as serious. They wanted more drama from Bogdanovich. I mean, there is a lot of humor in The Last Picture Show sprinkled through this tragedy.
I think that's important to point out, that it's not strictly a downbeat piece.
These little touches, like the girlfriend, when they're in the pickup truck making out, she like takes out her chewing gum and puts it by the mirror. And that awful scene with the Jimmy Sue character, it's a terrible scene where they're wanting the young boy to have his sexual encounter. But even she gets out of the truck and says, I normally don't do this for less than a dollar and a half, or something like that. And even the scene with the Coach Popper's wife and Timothy Bottoms, the creaking of the bed, it just takes the erotic pleasure out of the moment.
Misadventures of the football and basketball teams.
Precisely. So there's nostalgic satire in certain elements, but that's painful truths in so many others.
Well, and of course, there's a line towards the very end as they're walking out of Red River there at the movie theater. It's probably the last night for the theater. And one of the boys says, there won't be much to do in town with the picture show closed. And that's a line that's echoing in our hearts and minds, has been for months now. At this point, maybe we should throw it open to questions. Let's hear from our loyal audience and our new viewers.
We have somebody identified as iPad141.
I know that person. I'm joking.
Yeah, I just had a question about when I saw that movie, I think a year or two before or after, I also saw Johnny Got His Gun with Timothy Bottoms.
Came out the same year.
And Timothy Bottoms had that angelic look, and a lot of people thought he was going to be a superstar. And what happened to his career?
Well, he is going to have, there's a little bit of a boost after Last Picture Show. He is going to 2 years later appear in James Bridges' The Paper Chase, which was very, very successful. And then it gets pretty spotty after that. I mean, he's working constantly, but the artistic fire of this early period that we're seeing is not reignited in subsequent films. Bogdanovich was attracted to casting him because of his very sad eyes. And that definitely is appropriate for this part. But The Paper Chase was really his highlight after The Last Picture Show.
He had some bad luck. He was in some films that weren't successful one way or another. We were reminiscing about one of them, a good picture. It had never been very easy to see, called The White Dawn, which was filmed near the Arctic Circle in 1974, released by Paramount. Had the misfortune of A, being released in August, and B, the week that Richard Nixon resigned, which pretty much guaranteed that no one would ever see it.
So, never release a film when the president is abdicating his throne. Not a good marketing decision. But he was a good actor, Timothy Bottoms.
Yeah.
Thank you. SVHV?
Yeah, right.
Well,
I was sort of surprised after the funeral when Sam had given all these properties and money to people. He owned practically the whole town. So he really was the father of, and so with his dying, it's very clear that this is the end of the town, or the end of things as we've known it so far, the end of an era, you know, that he represents. I was wondering, you know, I mean, is that all we can say about that, or?
I think that's a fair assessment myself. I mean, the last shot, that extraordinary last panning shot through the desolate streets of Annarine, which were never that bustling to begin with the closing of the Royal Theater, it is the end of an era. Then Stam was the town. Gary might have some more doubt.
I think Annarine is based on a town, Max, called Archer. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, Bogdanovich actually filmed it in Archer City, Texas. He liked the look of it. And it just turned out that was Larry McMurtry's hometown. He was basing a lot of his material on Archer City.
I just saw the Pauline Kael movie that was part of the New Plaza Cinema collection that you recommended. And she talks about having come from a town like this. She talks about her assessment of HUD based on this kind of town where nothing happens and people are sort of, that she wanted to escape too. Mm-hmm. So, I wondered if she had anything to say about that. And I didn't understand why she said that, because she came from California. This was not Texas where she came from.
She was a big fan of The Last Picture Show also. And that's a beautiful piece. I can't remember how much that is quoted in the film, but she talks about seeing HUD in San Francisco on opening day in a packed theater and how the audience was reacting to Paul Newman. And HUD is on one of the subscription channels. I urge everybody to see it again if you haven't in a long time. But I think that Pauline Kael came from a kind of a hard scrabble California town, if I remember correctly, in that doc, which probably is the germinus for some of those feelings.
I seem to recall her original review of Last Picture Show. She complained she thought it was a little too much like a Peyton Place time type film. I would argue that it was more than that, but it certainly...
That's interesting. So you think, Max, that she did not review it favorably? We're going to have to...
I seem to recall she may have liked most of it, but I just remember she got, you know, she has to get her digs in. And I remember that was one little dig that she got, and that she thought it was a Peyton Place type narrative, which I say that's a little harsh.
Yeah, there's a part in the Pauline Kael movie where Bogdanovich is being interviewed about her, and he says, you know, she can be very nasty and mean.
Fairly accurate.
Well, he was a big boy. Of course, when you've been told when you're 32 years old that your film is as good as Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons, you know, you may have trouble getting your head through certain doors, and I think that may have happened to Bogdanovich. But to his credit, at a certain point, he just kept his head down and kept working, and he made some good pictures, which, again, Max and I recommend that you seek out.
Okay.
Absolutely. Kathleen Blanchard?
There's a lot of sex in the movie, but very little romance. And the romance seemed to be between intergenerations, older, younger, and with a parallel between the coach's wife and Sonny and Sam the Lion and JC's mom. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
I love you recognizing that, because it's ironic considering the era in which this came out. There was a big generation gap in the culture in this country, in music and in film. And it's rare to see a film of this era dealing with intergenerational relationships. Gary will probably be able to identify some that did. But I think that's a reflection on Bogdanovich himself had great reverence for the previous generation of directors. He was trying to keep the fire burning for the great craftsmen of the 30s and the 40s and the 20s. And so I find it fascinating that he's making a film in which there is this generational respect between the Timothy Bottoms character and Sam the Lion, for example. That's a wonderful observation. Gary might have something to add.
I remember Ellen Burstyn, of course, sardonically telling Sonny that, you know, that he and Ruth Popper, well, that sounds like a pretty good deal for both of you, doesn't it? And then he goes, does everybody in town know about that? So much emotion just in those few lines.
Yeah, but this is a great observation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Marianne?
I was impressed by the strengths, the different type of women in the movie. Could you explain more about all of them? Very different, but all of them very strong in their own way.
Thank you for that question. We also associate this era of the early 70s being not a good era for women's parts in Hollywood films. It was more an era of movies about male camaraderie, male bonding, not always in a positive way. So here you have a film where you do have some of the women roles are very memorable. And Gary, I believe you think that Polly Platt may have had a part in something.
I think absolutely, which is why I'm looking forward to delving into these podcasts, which talk about her life and her influence. And she's kind of the unsung heroine of the Last Picture Show. But I think Bogdanovich also, he had some kind of skill with actors, you know, from Barbra Streisand, Tatum O'Neill, Madeline Kahn, Sybil Shepherd, Patty Hansen, you know, the actress who's in our beloved The Thing Called Love. That's Samantha Mathis, right?
I mean, yes, Samantha Mathis.
Terrific female performances across a big swath of his career. And that's got to come from behind the camera.
Yeah, and he said he was kind of an exception during that time. I mean, obviously, there were, you know, Woody Allen and a few others that also offered roles for women, but he was never resistant to some good roles for women. I think especially because he was gravitating towards movies that deal in some way with romance. Even though we say in Last Picture Show that we don't see a lot of love between men and women, but certainly he was drawn towards relations between the sexes.
And some of the credit has to go to Larry McMurtry too, who wrote great female parts, you know, in his novels, and it showed on the screen in HUD in this film in Terms of Endearment.
And it's worth mentioning that the scene we saw with Sam the Lion, that scene where Ben Johnson is talking by the lake, that was not taken from the novel. Bogdanovich didn't like the original dialogue there. And he asked McMurtry, can you please write something more soulful here? And McMurtry wrote that monologue just for the film.
Well, Max, I think this is a good point for you to tell the story about speaking of President Nixon, the film's screening at the Nixon White House. You know, President Nixon was quite a film buff. He screened a lot of movies at the White House, and The Last Picture Show was screened there. Peter Bogdanovich and Sybil Shepherd attended, and possibly other members of the cast. So tell us what happened.
Well, here's the way I remembered it. When At Long Last Love came out, Bogdanovich was on the Phil Donahue show, and he was telling the story. And it was not at a screening of the film, but he was at some event where Nixon was. And he and Sybil Shepherd were introduced to the president. And Nixon, of course, was very taken with beautiful Sybil Shepherd. And he said, well, you know, young lady, you should be an actress yourself. And Bogdanovich said, well, you know, she is an actress. She was in my film, The Last Picture Show. And Nixon was thinking about this. He said, black and white? And Bogdanovich said, yes, it was a black and white film. I said, Texas in the 50s? Yes, that was the film. I saw that film. We screened it. It may have been at the White House or at his other home.
It's in the public record. You can see every film that every president screened. The information is out there.
There was a book written about that, actually. And at that point, once he remembered having seen it, he turned to Sybil Shepherd and he said, and what role did you play, young lady? And Bogdanovich, who may have had a little too much wine at that point, said, well, she was the one who stripped on the diving board. And Nixon sort of looked straight ahead into space and paused much longer than I have time for right now. And he sort of patted Sybil Shepherd on the hand and said, ah, yes, I remember you very well, my dear.
It doesn't get any wackier than that.
Our next question is from Susan.
I had two comments, two observations. One was that I was struck by the sort of post-Dust Bowl visuals, both in the spanning of the town itself, which looks so desolate, but there were Dust Bowls and the sweeping, of course, and it was really a big deal in the 30s and the 40s. And it was interesting that they captured that. And then I guess my second comment really had to do with the last line and the drama of the last line.
Never you mind, honey. Never you mind.
Which reminded me of Tennessee Williams when she says, I've always relied on the kindness of strangers, because there was an element of that sentiment in what she said.
It's a beautiful line.
It is. And when you describe the look of the film, we have to remember they're not doing this out of computers. They're not adding digitized dust to create something. This is actual effects that were created in camera to capture the dusty terrain of that town. And remarkably, the Royal Theater was an actual functioning movie theater at the time. So they didn't build that from scratch. It was all there.
The look of the theater, of course, was wonderful.
Extraordinary.
I mean, I hope that theaters like that are preserved across America.
No, it's a part of the heritage. But the look of the film is absolutely stunning. And we have to give kudos also to Robert Surtees, the veteran cinematographer. He had shot The Graduate and Ben-Hur, and he went back to MGM in the 50s and even earlier. He was a veteran. But a veteran taking on a more youthful project.
A famous story about Robert Surtees. Mike Nichols also wanted him to shoot Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, speaking of black and white films. And he encouraged Surtees to look at Fellini's 8.5. He wanted Virginia Woolf to look something like Fellini's 8.5. And Surtees supposedly said to him, that's murky junk. I'm not going to do that. And he quit the film. And Haskell Wexler was brought in to shoot it, and ironically won an Oscar for it. That's just the old guard didn't always see these influences as benignly as directors hoped.
And Surtees was more flexible than others of his generation. He was willing to go with the flow more than other older DPs were. But
and that same year, he shot The Summer of 42, a beautiful piece of color cinematography in the same year.
Yeah, so 71 was an important year in general for Duffman.
This discussion was facilitated by film historian Max Alvarez and resident film curator Gary Palmucci. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making the creation of this podcast possible. This podcast was produced and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh, yours truly. Separately, I would also like to give a special shout out to my partner Ross Cooper for inspiring me to cover this one-of-a-kind film. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and take care.